I refuse to testify on the grounds that my organs will be chopped up into a patty.
Ah, the 67th Amendment.
For a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
Can you see Captain Blackadder anywhere in this courtroom?
That's him! That's him! That's the man!
Ah! No more questions, sir.
Silence, or you'll be held in contempt of this court.
I have nothing but contempt for this court.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 93. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your better-looking host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
Well, I'm great now. Thank you for that lovely compliment.
I saw the cartoon that was drawn of us, a little teaser for later, and I think you look great in it, so that's what we'll go with.
I feel the same way about you. You've got that,
I've got that hipster
everyone's
going
to have to
cut.
See it, yeah. Just to judge for themselves.
It might be a new logo. Well, we're just a teaser here. We'll see how it goes. All right. Lots of cool stuff to cover today. Action-packed, as always. But Andrew, you want to talk about some appearances you've made?
Yeah, we plugged these last Friday, but it is worth mentioning again. If you just can't get enough Andrew in your life, and you know,
Who can?
I understand that. It's a common problem. I was on three separate podcasts in the past week and a half. I was on Utah Outcasts, episode 113. I was on our buddy Detective Matthew Maxson's show, The Odd Atheist Friends, episode number 14. And Hall of Fame patron Pascal Romero. I was on his show, Squaring the Strange, episode number 10. And as Thomas teased, they released they gave us a just a delightful cartoon that you're just gonna have to wait to see.
Yeah,
on
it's
that.
Pretty brilliant.
But check out those three shows. They're linked in the show notes, and give them a listen.
Definitely.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
All right, and now it's time for our show here. Question one. This is a listener question. This is from my brother-in-law, Sage. He asked an interesting question about what we thought was clear as Kushner, I think, with the Russian email that Don Jr. just agreed to go receive something of value for his campaign, you know, for. And his question was, you seem to assume something nefarious. Good guess with the Trump clan, but honestly, I don't see it in this case. If somebody says they have dirt on my opponent, I would meet with them. If it turns out to be a thing of value and my lawyers say I can't accept it for free, I would pay for it. If I followed your reasoning correctly, wouldn't that be a sufficient explanation? I actually think it's probably true in this case. It seems to clear to me that there didn't turn out to be a thing of value, but you've been saying for weeks that just meeting with them, regardless of whether there was anything, shows his part in the conspiracy. Is there anything illegal in getting information that makes Clinton look bad if they intend to pay for it? So the statute you mentioned, you went into it, was you can't receive a thing of value for a campaign, but does merely paying for it, does that, I suppose, obviate that? Does that just, it's like, okay, I can't receive a donation, but if you've got dirt on my opponent, Russia, or some sort of Russian official, can I just pay you $10 for it or whatever the value is? And then that solves that problem.
Yeah. And the answer to that is very obviously not, for at least two reasons, right? So the first is, consider election law generally, right? Like, the predicate of this question is, it's no longer an illegal campaign contribution if you give the money back or you pay for the thing of value. And let me point out that if that were the case, you could never charge and arrest anybody in connection with the election laws, right? Yeah. Like it would always be essentially a civil case. Oh, look, like, you know, so mobsters gave, you know, Hillary Clinton $1 million. Oh, but Hillary Clinton just wrote a check for $1 million payable to the mob. Okay, no crime here.
Right.
Like there's that level of sort of preposterousness to the question to begin. It is significantly more serious, and this is clear from the case law, when you are talking about a foreign government or foreign nationals, right? And this underscores the premise that the baseline, the thing we do not want to have happen is we never want the American public to be in the situation that they're in right now, which is, and I get, you know, maybe Sage doesn't feel this way, but an overwhelming plurality of the country is not sure whether the results of our election were engineered in part by a hostile foreign nation. And I can't think of anything that is more deleterious to democracy. Again, regardless of who the president is, mm-hmm. whether it's a Democrat or Republican, then the country having a justified belief that that happened, right? So look, if this was all like Trump said, remember, Trump's argument here is not, it's perfectly okay for me to meet with the Russians. Trump's argument is, oh, I know that's all info. Yeah, that's all fake news. And, you know, the liberal failing New York Times and CNN, and they're all making it up, right? His argument is not, yeah, I met with the Russians and that's okay. Hold on, Cliff.
So you're talking about Trump Jr.
Yes.
Okay.
So the principle is...
Well, his argument has been what Sage said, which is, oh, yeah, well, they didn't end up having anything, right? Like, I just went...
The administration's position has been, these are fake news stories, right? The administration has not taken
the position
of... Like Russia
as a whole, you mean? Like just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
That it's okay to meet with the Russians, right? They have taken the position of, if there was a meeting, then, you know, nothing of value was exchanged because they were just giving us dirt on Hillary Clinton, right? So, but again, and we're going to link the statute in the show notes. We did it in episode 88, but it's worth doing it again. Here's what the law says. Okay, this is 52 USC 30121, and it says, it shall be unlawful for a foreign national, comma, directly or indirectly, to make a contribution or donation of money or other thing of value, the dossier counting as that, or to make an express or implied promise to make a contribution or donation in connection with a federal, state, or local election. And that is about as comprehensive as a law can possibly be. And it reflects the bipartisan belief at the time that this law was passed, 1976. And you might think, 1976, I wonder what, right? Like, this was an era in which the Congress representatives from both parties were concerned about election integrity.
Yeah.
It was also the height of the Cold War. And you can find testimony on the floor of the House of Representatives of the last thing we would want is for people to think the Russians are interfering in our elections.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that used to be a concern.
And so,
true.
Yeah. Right. In fact, that was the, you know, major divide in the Democratic Party between anti-communist hawks like Mo Udall and, you know, those in the Democratic Party who were perceived as being sort of insufficiently tough on communism, right? The language, you are hard-pressed to find a statute, we've talked about this in other cases, that says it is illegal to directly or indirectly to make an express or implied promise make a contribution or donation. And so what that means in practice, and again, we will get on an election law attorney. I've got somebody lined up. I didn't have the opportunity to this week. It is common practice. Talk to Republican campaign operatives, right? It is common practice in the campaign industry. If you get the call that says, hey, you know, this is, you know, X foreign national representing Y government, and I have a thing like you, that is a, you hang up the phone and you inform the authorities, right? Like, this is not an area where, you know, there's play in the joints and you can kind of pussy. Well, we were just curious what the Russians might have to, like, it's a no-go zone, right? Like, they can't, the moment that a foreign national promises to do something for a campaign, federal, state, or local, you absolutely are required to notify the authorities, wash your hands, make a full disclosure in order to avoid prison. Okay.
Yeah.
And
well, and as you pointed out, I think I asked at the time because it sounded like the statute was directed at the foreign national. There's another, isn't there another clause that's like, yep, you also can't accept it or you can't, isn't there another clause that applies to whoever's getting it?
Yep. That was A1A. If we jump down, B says a contribution or donation to a committee or political party. C says an expenditure, independent expenditure, or disbursement for an electioneering communication. Right. And disbursement for electioneering communication means they pay for your signs. Right. Mm. Like, I mean, so it is as comprehensive as possible. That's all section one. Section two says, or a person to solicit, accept, or receive a contribution or donation described in subparagraph A or B of paragraph one from a foreign national. Right. So they get you coming and going. The conspiracy could apply on both ends, right? Like it is a conspiracy to help a foreign national make that promise, implied promise indirectly to aid a campaign, right? So it is just
just to make sure we're covering all our bases. Does this mean that just people who are foreign nationals can't work in any capacity on a computer? Like, could you? Let's say there's some sort of business or something and they provide a service of any kind and it's not going to be a contribution. It's 100% just an exchange of goods and, you know, for money or whatever. They can't do that if they're a foreign national, like they can't work on campaigns at all.
So I would like to ask that question of an election law lawyer. But I would say the distinction there, so it's defined, right? This was all subsection A. Subsection B defines what a foreign national is. Okay. And says, as used in this section, the term foreign national means a foreign principal or an individual who is not a citizen of the United States or a national of the United States and who is not lawfully admitted for permanent residence as defined by section 1101A20 of Title 8.
Well, so that could be where, like, if you were just somebody who was in the country legally, that's where that could be different than if you're literally in the Russian government, like just abroad somewhere.
Right. So, and there, I mean, I think the question would be, right, if it's found that you have, let's say you have a print shop that is sending out Donald Trump mailers, and the fact that they may have, you know, illegally hired an alien, right, slipped through the I-9 process to lick the envelope, nobody is going to enforce that election law against the Trump campaign, right? Like, because the person doing the thing there would be the corporate person of, you know, the entity that, you know, the direct mail outfit, right? So, like, yeah, you know, could you invent an absurd hypothetical, I think, but I think the law would fairly reasonably, you know, discriminate on the basis of that absurd hypothetical. But again, I just want to point out there is zero doubt. I mean, this is the build the wall party, right?
Yeah.
Like, the people defending Donald Trump here are, you know, the ones who are supposed to want to make America great again. And the idea that making America great again is let's turn the other way when the Russians conspire to violate our election laws is just, it's honestly mind-boggling to me. And again, you know, one of the things you and I have tried to do, I don't suggest that I'm not partisan. I don't even suggest that I might, you know, have an unconscious double standard in some of the, I'm sure I do. That's the definition of what it means to be a human. But I am 100% certain that if Hillary Clinton were president and what we were determining right now was that members of a foreign government, let's say that the conspiracy theories about the Clinton Global Initiative turned out to be correct, and that like major African nations had lined up, and it was demonstrated that like the premier of Togo, you know, sent an envoy to meet with Hillary Clinton to give her a confidential dossier containing information on how to defeat Donald Trump. Like, that would be a crime, and I would say that on the air, and I hope that I have enough credibility with our listeners that I've gone after enough Democrats.
Yeah.
You know, for that to be clear, it's 100% clear. And if I were on here dissembling about like, well, maybe they were going to buy it after they got it, but you got to try it before you buy it. Like, that's not the way our laws work.
Yeah.
Right. Our laws say if you're a foreign national, hands off our election. And, you know, and again, we are seeing precisely, I mean, they've been subverted as far as I can tell, but we're seeing why these laws were passed, right? Like this is, you know, I made the analogy to, you know, to Pete Rose and gambling on baseball, right? Like this is the crisis of confidence. The worst thing you can do in a democracy is have a legitimate reason for a majority of citizens to think that the election didn't truly reflect the will of the people of this country.
Yeah.
And that's why the law is there. And I'm kind of shocked by this response. Yeah. So
sounds like what's happened is the state media, Fox News, has the official Republican branch of the media, Fox News, has made it so that the absurd and laughable defense that the Trump administration has used has become plausible to people that it previously should not have been plausible to because of where they get their news. Is what that sounds like what could be happening.
Yep. And I would be shocked. We've made this disanalogy before, but you know, use my Hillary Clinton foreign, you know, corruption. I would not expect any, even I certainly would not expect, you know, Andrea Mitchell to line up behind these stories. But I wouldn't expect any of the political opinion hosts, you know, Rachel Maddow or Chris Hayes or Lawrence O'Donnell to line up and be like, well, you know, we shouldn't have this overly technical reading of foreign governments, you know, giving aid and preparing dossiers for the Hillary Clinton campaign. Like, of course you would be outraged, right? You should be outraged. And you know, this is the consequence.
Well, it's the consequence of incompetence. It's the consequence of thinking that outsiders have all our answers. They just, you know, I think it's plausible that Don Jr. just had no idea that this was against the law. Like, I do think there's every possibility, especially with how he handled it, because he just like released the email and like went on TV. He just didn't know that this was really, really illegal, I think.
Yeah. Well, and look, like that goes back to, that's a little bit of a callback to the unfortunate case we handled last week, you know, in which I was of the opinion that the Second Circuit was correct that not knowing the law and not having a lawyer is not a legal excuse, right? And there's the flip side of it, right? Like, yeah, there's no doubt in my mind Donald Trump Jr. had probably the same view that Sage has here, right? Like, are you really saying that, like, I mean, I want to beat somebody. I would meet with anybody who would help me beat my opponent. Well, you know, you don't meet with the Russians, right? Like, that's just what the law says. And the fact that Donald Trump Jr. didn't know that. And,
yeah, I'm not offering it as a defense. I'm offering it as a explanation for his behavior.
No. I understand the purpose by which you're offering it. I'm saying I think this is sort of a further illustration of my efforts consistent.
Because what we always have here with this Trump stuff and the people who somehow still support him and buy into this bullshit is there's two worldviews that collide, and when I suppose a Republican or a Trump supporter sees Don Jr. saying, you know, being forthcoming, saying, look, here's what I did. No big deal. There's two explanations. Like, one is the left has gone nuts and is making something out of nothing. And that's consistent with, oh, yeah, see, he went on TV, released it. No big deal. The other is he has no idea how friggin' illegal this was and thinks he didn't do anything wrong, but actually did something incredibly illegal. That, like, both those explanations fit. And you're saying it's the second one.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So what, but I guess this is, you know, but what is going to happen? Like, something's going to happen with this, right? I mean, if what you're saying is true, you know, like what's the next step here? What's happening?
The next step is to determine whether there is a connection between the inner circle of the Trump campaign and Donald Trump himself and Donald Trump Jr.'s meetings, right? And so we've already started to see that, right? Like, there's the report this week.
But does that mean that Donald Trump Jr. is going to face jail time or something? Like, does that mean?
Again, as sort of, remember that the scope of the Mueller investigation includes any criminal activity in uncovered as a result of his investigation of the connection with Russia. So Mueller is empowered to investigate this. News came out this week that President Trump wrote the response that Donald Trump Jr. gave to the Russians at the meeting. And so, you know, what you try and do is see how much of a case you can build against Donald Trump as part of this potential conspiracy.
Okay, so we're waiting on the investigation, essentially.
Yep.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, thanks for answering that. Thanks for the questions. Thanks for listening, especially to all conservatives, Trump supporters, people who don't agree with us. Thanks for listening. We definitely appreciate it. It's interesting to hear from the other side on that, but sounds like that one is straightforward.
It's the easiest way to get your question on the air. Tell us you're a pro-Trump conservative or an anti-Trump conservative and you disagree with us and, you know, we'll give you 15 minutes.
Or be married to us. So one or the other. Those are the two best ways to get.
That is the only way to get me to go down the Kim Kardashian rabbit hole is to be married to Thomas. Yeah, so yeah. There you go.
All right, Andrew, affirmative action. We're going to talk about, this is the story that the Trump White House, the Justice Department is going to investigate whether or not we're being really unfair to white people in this country. Is that something like what's happening?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There was a report in the New York Times August 1st that the Trump administration is going to direct the Civil Rights Division to investigate and file lawsuits on behalf of white people challenging college admission programs that emphasize diversity, that are under the rubric of what we call affirmative action. Massively significant because obviously there are limited resources and lawyers, and taking the Civil Rights Division and saying the important civil rights in this country are of reasonably decent but not great white students who don't get admitted to the top college of their choice is, like I said, elections have consequences. Mm-hmm. And here you go. You know, this puts a strong lie to, you know, those folks on the left who say, it's all the same, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, there is no doubt. I mean, we could do a laundry list of stuff Trump has done, and you could add this to the list of things that this would not be happening if we had a Democratic president. So I thought this was a great time to discuss because we've got, you know, kind of this current events hook. But I think there's a lot of misconception about what affirmative action is, particularly in terms of higher education in this country. I thought there'd be a great opportunity to kind of do a deeper dive on it. And so I'm going to start off with, and maybe this is unfair, we've got a bar question pending, but I'm going to ask you, Thomas, what do you think when I talk about permissible forms of affirmative action by colleges and universities in the United States? What does that mean to you? What do you think they can do and they can't do?
Oh, man. I would think that I really don't know. I'm not an expert on this, besides being, you know, a lawyer and everything. But besides that, just my casual being a lawyer experience, I would guess that they can factor it in, but that they can't just outright admit based on like race quotas or something. I mean, that would be a guess that I would think that they could somehow use it in the scoring, but it can't be like the main thing.
Yeah, that is exactly right. That's the distinction. So let's quantify that.
Okay.
Right. Suppose you have a college that has that admits 100 students, right? And it is in a state. It's a state university that is in a state that is 35% African American, 35% minority of all sources, okay, and 65% white, right? What you can't do is say, we're only going to take 65 white kids, right? And
right.
Then, oh, look, we've handed out our admissions to the first 65 white kids that have been, and even though you're relatively, like, all the white kids' spots are filled, right?
Yeah.
That's what quotas are, and that is plain under the Supreme Court that system is not permissible. So what system is permissible? This is a case, the most recent case is Fisher versus the University of Texas at Austin, which we'll link in the show notes. It's a 2016 decision. It's a post-Scalia decision. It is 4-3. And the reason it's 4-3 is because when Elena Kagan was Solicitor General, she worked on this case. So she had to recuse herself. So 4-3, it would have been 5-3 with Elena Kagan. So presumably, even though we have Neil Gorsuch filling Scalia's role, both figuratively as well as literally, it would be 5-4 if it were to come up today. But I'm going to talk about some really unique aspects of the Fisher case. But I think the first thing that's worth talking about is, what is the system that the University of Texas at Austin used that was challenged by Fisher? And we should explain, Fisher was a white girl who didn't get admitted to the University of Texas at Austin.
Did we cover this, or am I just remembering this news story?
I don't.
Okay, so it just was a news story. I remember the picture of the girl that was, you know, didn't.
Yeah.
That made the rounds. Yeah. She didn't get in, so. She's filed a lawsuit. Okay.
So she had to go to, I believe, a Louisiana State University instead. I don't know how one would rank LSU versus UT at Austin. I know if you're a baseball player, LSU's a better get. Mm. But she went to LSU instead of UT Austin, filed a lawsuit. And it's important to understand her position, you know, where she came. So how do kids get into the University of Texas at Austin? First, Texas has a law called the top 10% law. This law says exactly what it sounds like. If you're in the top 10% of your high school class, you are automatically admitted to any of the state schools within the University of Texas system.
Right.
So the UT Austin fills 75% of its incoming student body via the top 10% law. Okay, so that takes out 3/4 of the class. Of the rest of the and I should add that top 10% law has some effect on diversity. So as of 2013, that meant under that top 10% law, it meant 4.5% of applicants were African American, 17.9% were Asian American, 16.9% were Hispanic. Okay, so not fully representative of the populace, underrepresenting African Americans, but top 10 laws, because if you think about how perversely how segregated many school districts are, right? If you are now in the top 10% in your class in a heavily African American high school that has the effect of admitting more African Americans than just a good old boy network might do it.
Okay.
So I just want to be clear. There's some diversity impact to having the top 10%. Then the remaining 25% of the spots are filled by an overall, what they call the holistic plan. And the holistic plan has two components. Okay. And both components are ranked from 1 to 6, with 6 being the best. So 50% of this holistic plan is what they call AI, the academic index, which is just your ranking in your school class plus your SAT score. And then 50% is what they call the personal achievement index. And the personal achievement index is, and I realize that we are nesting through a lot of things.
Yeah.
I'm going to give away the punchline. The punchline is just how tiny a factor race is in this.
Okay.
But it is worth explaining how nested this is, right? So 25% of the spots go to the people who have the best average of this AI plus PAI, academic index plus personal achievement index. And that is a strict cutoff, and nobody knows what the underlying components are, right? So it's just whoever scores the highest, right? Mm-hmm. And they're ranked on 1 to 6. So, you know, you take all the 12s, 11s, 10s, you have a cutoff at, you know, 9 or whatever. That personal academic index. And so the academic index is just objective school ranking plus SAT. It's just numbers. I shouldn't say it's objective, because obviously there are some questions about the racial bias of the SAT that are beyond the scope of this podcast, but it's just numbers.
Okay.
The PAI is subjective, and it is determined 50% by reviewers reading and grading your two required admissions essays. Okay.
All right.
And then 50% by another reviewer assigning you a personal achievement score of 1 to 6 that is kind of a subjective factor. That subjective factor has three components. A, another grade of your essay. B, any supplemental information such as recommendations, optional writing samples, optional essays. And C, potential contributions to the university.
Mm.
Potential contributions to the university has five components to this. I know, again, bear with me. Geez. Those five components are: one, leadership; two, extracurricular activities; three, awards and honors; four, community service; and five, special circumstances. You may be guessing.
Do we get some more subcategories of special circumstances? Yep. Here we go.
Special circumstances has seven subcategories. Oh, socioeconomic status of the school that you attended, family responsibilities, that is, if many high school kids, particularly in inner city areas, are required to, you know, work jobs to contribute to the family. And so it's obviously far more impressive if you're working 30 hours a week when you're 16 to help keep your family alive, that you also got, you know, a 3.1 GPA than if you got a 3.1 GPA and you spent your free time, you know, playing video games. Mm-hmm. Family responsibility. Number four, is it a single parent home? Again, same thing. You want to put your thumb on the scale for somebody that comes out of a single parent home, because in addition to maybe they have job, or, you know, they have more work around the house, right? There's just people to help. Number five, an index of your SAT score versus the SAT scores at your school, right? So again, right,
if you're overperforming relative to like your schoolmates.
Yeah. If you're at a school that the average SAT score, well, it's now on the, 2,400, 1,600 when I was taking it. Were you a 2,400 guy?
No, I was just before that took place.
Yeah. So I was just a little bit before that. So, but right. I mean, it's easy to imagine.
I was 400 actually. It was back. They hadn't invented.
It's just, it really, there was on a scale of 1 to 3. Yeah. They were like, oh, you know, and I got a 3. It was good. No, obviously, you know, if your class average is a 2000 and you get a 2100, versus if your class average is a 1200 and you get a 2000, you know, that
means you would excel. You would think you would excel in your circumstances. Like maybe if you had gone to a better school, maybe you'd be even better, or something like that. Okay.
Because schools with more resources often spend class time doing SAT prep. Schools with fewer resources have less ability to do that. Right. So that's number five. Number six, the primary language spoken in the home. Again, recognizing that if you have graduated from a school learning English as your second language, that's more impressive than somebody who English is their first language, mm-hmm. right? And number seven, right, race.
Yeah.
So this was properly described by Anthony Kennedy in the Fisher decision as a factor of a factor of a factor.
Yeah.
And I think that may leave out a factor, right? Like, I mean, it is, right? As we've said, this is 25% of the entrants look at this score at all. Of those, half the score is numeric. Half the score is then broken down into something where half the score of that is your essays. And then the other half is your essays plus some other stuff. And then in that other stuff, one of the things is special circumstances. And in special circumstances, one of the things is race. Right. It is difficult to imagine when the word that is used under law is holistic, I might use the word attenuated, right? Like it is, if this process were to be struck down, then no college anywhere could employ any kind of method to bring kids onto campus to try and promote racial diversity at all.
Yeah, it seems very specific. Like a very small factor.
So why do colleges want to do that? And again, there certainly are people, right? I get the, and we're going to get, feel free to write in if you want to say, that's right. The policy should be completely racially neutral. I don't have a time to go through all of those arguments, but I will give you, this is just the evidence from the Fisher case itself, which is that in 2002, prior to the entry of this policy, at the University of Texas at Austin, right? Which again, this is Texas. This is not, we're not talking about Vermont, right? I get it. If you've got a state that is 98% white, it's pretty difficult. The University of Vermont is probably a pretty white campus, right? But Texas is a racially diverse state. And here are the numbers. And again, either this strikes you as something you want to do something about, or it doesn't. But to me, it clearly does. 52% of classes at the University of Texas in 2002 had zero African-American students, and an additional 27% had only one African-American student in the class. So that means 4 out of 5 classes did not have at least 2 black people in the class. And the notion, this is sort of pervasive in affirmative action literature. There was a notion of helping to foster an environment where there is a critical mass of minority students on campus. And so if you are an African-American student and you are literally the only black person in your class, right, that the sociological literature is really rife with explanations of how psychologically demoralizing that kind of environment is. And just, and we're not talking about, and look, like, you know, in a, think about like in a lecture hall class,
yeah,
like many classes at UTA, right? Like we're not talking about a school. This is not a small liberal arts school, right? University of Texas at Austin is a big school. And we're talking about being in a lecture hall with 200, 300 students and looking around and you're the only kid who's like you in that class. And we're just only talking about getting up to, is there another one, right?
Yeah.
Is there somebody else like me in this class? And 4 out of 5 classes, the answer was no. And so if you care about not discouraging minority students to drop out of college, then you might say to yourself, well, gosh, I would like to create an environment in which, like, you're not the one weird kid in your class, right? Like, in which we have that, quote, critical mass to be able to change the experience that African-American students have on campus. Now, that doesn't persuade you. Send us the email. Maybe we'll dive into it. But I think that is fairly persuasive to a fairly broad segment of people, right? Hardcore conservative, I get it. But we've already said, look, we're not talking about a quota system. We're not talking about taking an obviously qualified white student and replacing them with an unqualified black student. We're talking about, can the university look at its makeup and go, gosh, I would sure like to have more diversity on campus.
Yeah.
I would sure like to create an environment that is more welcoming for our minority students. That's the program that was challenged in Fisher versus Texas. And I need to tell you, this was a tremendous uphill battle for the university to defend this program. Again, I'm going to cut to the punchline. The Supreme Court, we've already said this, the Supreme Court affirmed 4-3, right? But the Supreme Court affirmed this program 4-3 given the following legal constraints on it, right? So the first is, and all of these remain law, right? So the first is, its admissions policy had to pass strict scrutiny. We've talked about this in previous episodes. Strict scrutiny almost always means that the policy or law loses. and here, this is one of the very few examples of something that did pass strict scrutiny.
So it would pass strict scrutiny. I don't know. Right. I didn't know if that was necessarily true.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. So the first case came up in 2013 and was remanded back to the trial court for further findings. And then the second case came up in 2016 after they complied with that request. So number one, had to meet strict scrutiny. Number two, the standard for deference to the university's findings is, quote, some but not total deference to the school. So in other words, when the school says this is the only way, or this is the only way we've come up with within the constraints that have been placed on us to increase diversity in our classrooms, the Supreme Court said, yeah, we're not going to completely credit that. We're going to reserve for ourselves the right to second guess your conclusions. Okay. And then number three, that the school bears the burden of proof. And we've talked about the significance of that, but the burden of proving that available, workable, race neutral alternatives are insufficient to achieve those goals to which, again, we've described as only granting kind of partial deference, right? So that is, as you're listening to that, you might think, boy, that's a really uphill battle.
Yeah.
And it really, really is. And I should point out that from the first case in 2013, that Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote both cases, right? He wrote the 2013 Fisher case, we could call Fisher One. That's what the Supreme Court does, that remanded for further findings and set out these legal standards. And look, if I were the University of Texas at Austin, I would look at that and go, oh boy, we're in trouble when we come back up. Because usually when the court says, you got to pass strict scrutiny, oh, and by the way, we reserve the right to second guess your findings. Oh, and by the way, you bear the burden of proof of showing that the available alternatives don't work. That's usually a pretty strong signal that that you're going to lose.
Yeah.
And then, but they didn't lose. They won on in Fisher 2. And in Fisher 2, what Anthony Kennedy said was, we set forth these controlling principles. We took a look at everything. And in light of the totality of the circumstances, we think the University of Texas at Austin has met its burden of proving that the plan satisfies strict scrutiny, that the need for racial diversity on campus, the educational benefits that flow from student body diversity, is how the court puts it, is a compelling interest. It promotes cross-racial understanding, helps to break down racial stereotypes, and enables students to better understand persons of different races. It promotes learning outcomes and better prepares students for an increasingly diverse workforce and society. And that in doing so, that the school went through a reasonable process to achieve those goals, and that the alternatives of just sticking with a purely numeric or sticking with going with 100% of the top 10% applicants, which is one of the things suggested by the plaintiff, Abigail Fisher, were not sufficient, that they met kind of that third prong. So this is a good case, but it's a good case backed up by really, really difficult law behind it. It will not surprise you to learn that in dissent, Justice Alito called this affirmative action gone berserk, right? Direct quote, right? It's harder to imagine a more attenuate, right?
Yeah.
Factor one of seven, of factor one of five, of factor one of three, of 50% of something that applies to 25% of the student body, right? That's the level of attenuation.
It really is hard to imagine how much of an impact that even makes.
Yeah. And that is Alito saying gone berserk, right? So once you've used that level of hyperbole, like, you know, God help him if this had been one of the five sub factors, right? So Samuel Alito called this affirmative action gone berserk. Clarence Thomas has said multiple times in concurrence in Fisher 1 and in dissent in Fisher 2 that he thinks schools may not use race, may not consider race, period, right? That is flat prohibition, that a school can't enact a program like this. And, Roberts has no written opinions on the subject, and we have pretty good idea where Neil Gorsuch is going to come out.
Yeah.
So, you know, the question is, this was one of the cases, you and I talked about this. I was preparing in October of 2016 for really great deep dive opening arguments on Anthony Kennedy's, the signals for the coming 2017 Supreme Court term, of how he was going to move left to join the
Merrick Garland
liberal permanent majority, thanks to Merrick Garland or whomever President Clinton was going to appoint to the Supreme Court. Had to junk all that. But Fisher was one of those cases, right? Like the difference between 2013 and 2016, where Kennedy seemed, pretty hostile to the program, to approving the program in 2016. I can tell you in the legal community that the Fisher decision came out as a surprise. And it was one of the pieces of kind of evidence out there. I believe that Anthony Kennedy was getting ready to have a comfortable role in the middle to the back bench on the court's new liberal majority. I don't know how comfortable. It's why I take seriously the rumors that Anthony Kennedy is considering retiring from the bench. I don't think he likes being the focal point of the Supreme Court. Mm. And he really has no choice but to be, right? Like there are three hardcore judicial activists on the court, and there's John Roberts, who is a very, very conservative jurist, and so there's almost automatically four votes.
He just can't help but be the swing vote. It sounds like.
Yeah. And so, I just think, again, this is total speculation, but I think Anthony Kennedy does not like being the center of attention on that, does not like this going, this in effect being, the question, but this is what it boils down to, right? When the Trump Justice Department says, we want to tee up cases over the next couple of years, that is a concerted effort to pair up a conservative political appointees in the Department of Justice with conservative judicial activists on the Supreme Court, and to take advantage of the fact that the underlying legal landscape is very hostile to affirmative action programs. And oh, as a benefit, like maybe something might happen to Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Anthony Kennedy while these cases are being teed up, right? Because this is something that is going to come to fruition a couple of years down the line. And there's just no doubt in my mind that, this is meant to take advantage and start teeing up these cases because you might be able to change the political direction. You already have changed the political direction, but to sort of further accelerate that change over the coming years. So that's kind of my deep dive into
the Justice Department is investigating how wronged white people are by this policy. That's nothing. Is that what I'm
correct
to understand? So how representative of other colleges would this policy be? Do we know?
Yeah, I failed to share some of the more hilarious facts from the Fisher case, right? So Abigail Fisher, not in the top 10% of her class, right?
Yeah.
Right. So not, even if one of the proposals that was put out by Fisher's lawyers was, scrap this additional 25% and just do top 10% for everybody, which you could do. But by that metric, she wouldn't have been admitted
to
the University
bizarre.
Of Texas at Austin.
Yeah.
Right. It is just the notion. I mean, this goes back to in my lifetime, what I consider the most deplorable human being, word chosen directly, to have ever served in the United States Senate is racist monster Jesse Helms from North Carolina. Mm. And in 1984, his campaign against African-American, I believe he was mayor of Charlotte, Harvey Gantt, the linchpin of that campaign was hands were an ad that featured white hands filling up three quarters of the screen, crumpling a piece of paper. And the voiceover was, you earned that job. You were qualified for that job, but they gave it to some minority, and and you're mad, and the hands crumple it up and throw it away. And it was, not racially coded, right?
Yeah,
it was. Hey, white people,
no,
don't vote for the black guy, and it was very, very close. But Jesse Helms was reelected to the Senate. This is another example when you send out the message of we're going to target affirmative action on behalf of white people, that is not dog whistling. That is, blasting noise at maximum volume through a loudspeaker.
Regular whistling.
Like it is well beyond regular whistling.
That's a
whistling.
Test of the emergency services. Whatever.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's exactly right. It is naked racism to appeal to the only group, one of the only subgroups that still supports, as of yesterday, Trump's approval rating was at 36%. And when you look at the subgroups, like the subpopulations are, Republicans.
Oh, yeah. White people are the only major demographic who support, supports Trump.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yep. And
stick with your base.
And that's what this is. So,
all right. Well, that's absurd. And thanks for taking us through that. I can't believe how little of a factor race is in that decision. That's, I had no idea it was that attenuated, as you said. That's crazy. So, all right. Thanks for taking us through that.
Thank you, Dr. Hibbert. I rest my case.
You rest your case?
What? Oh, no. I thought that was just a figure of speech. Case closed.
All right. Ooh, here we go. Andrew, a lot of people have been sending us this. The closed arguments here. John Oliver's case. There was, I think, an amicus brief was filed by the ACLU. Is that right? And that's the news that I've seen everybody send us.
Yes. The ACLU of West Virginia, an attorney, Jamie Lynn Crofts. And Ms. Crofts, if you want to come on the show, you are welcome on this show anytime. Send us an email. This is the best legal brief in the history of legal briefs. So remember, we covered the lawsuit being filed by Bob Marshall against John Oliver for John Oliver's coverage of Marshall on his HBO show Last Week Tonight. That's a private defamation lawsuit. So the ACLU is not a party. So they filed an amicus curiae, which means friends of the court brief, which urging not only dismissal of the case, but that the court sua sponte, that is of its own volition, should impose sanctions on the plaintiffs for filing what is essentially a frivolous lawsuit. We have talked about this before. The court does have the inherent power to sanction litigants. It's very rarely exercised, but this is great. So the lawsuit brings up a number of interesting facts that are sort of worth going through, but it's also worth reading some of the headers for the arguments, because I really feel like I litigate my legal practice kind of on the edge, and I have never gotten the opportunity, even having Eli Bosnick as a client, of writing a brief this spectacularly. So it begins with some facts that I didn't know but suspected, which is that Bob Murray has filed 7 lawsuits that were dismissed at the motion to dismiss stage for defamation in Ohio when people have said bad things about him.
Well, 8th time's a charm.
Yeah, well, and this is page 2 of the brief, but there's a long string cite in which they say, see Murray versus Tarley, see Murray versus Knight Ritter, Murray versus the Huffington Post. And then this delightful summary of, after this long list of losses in Ohio, it appears that Bob Murray has now decided to try his luck with abusing West Virginia's court system. Then the subsection B of this is the ridiculous case at hand. And that actually summarizes a lot of the things that we picked out when we were discussing the lawsuit. And then the free speech argument, section 3, is headlined, anyone can legally say, quote, eat shit, Bob, end quote. which I have...
I got some comedians again, working just, for the ACLU, is what you're saying.
I am really jealous. Ms. Crofts is a terrific writer.
Can we file amicus briefs? Can we do this as a
yes.
Patreon goal?
Oh, we should. Yeah. Absolutely. And that, you know, the heading is... this case is beyond meritless. It is offensive to the very ideals of free speech embodied in the First Amendment. The fact that plaintiffs filed this case is ridiculous enough, but to pour gasoline on the fire, plaintiff's counsel has also filed a motion asking the court to make John Oliver not say mean things about him anymore. It is frankly shocking that plaintiffs were able to find attorneys willing to file a lawsuit that is so obviously unconstitutional. And then in the list of explanations, it is all of the headers use the same characterization of speech that John Oliver has tried to use. So it says, plaintiff's motion for temporary restraining order is ridiculous. Courts can't tell media companies how to report, Bob. All of John Oliver's speech was protected by the First Amendment. You can't sue people for being mean to you, Bob. and I think I'm going to use this for the episode, for the show notes, the episode graphic. There is one of the complaints in the lawsuit was that John Oliver compared Bob Murray to Dr. Evil. And there is a delightful photo of Dr. Evil next to Bob Murray, and the two are virtually identical.
Oh my
He's
God.
Got the same. It's just
this is gold.
It's a visual gag. I'm going to put it as the cover photo for this episode. It's spectacular.
Bravo, ACLU.
Bravo, ACLU. It's important because there are a couple of things here. I mean, number one, you know, we laughed and made fun of the lawsuit. You know, here's somebody who's not, they're the ACLU, right? You know what? You dismiss them as much as you want. You don't file a brief like this if you are not exceptionally confident in the legal standards because Right? Because filing a brief that is this insulting if you're wrong on the law is almost certain to get you sanctioned.
Yeah.
Right? And also I liked that they request that the court sua sponte issue sanctions. I thought it was super interesting to know the history of Murray's frivolous litigation. And I would say we often encourage our listeners to read the original court documents. This is a great time to go read the original court documents. So it's only a 16-page brief. You can knock it out in however long it takes you to read 16
For
pages.
For me, a couple weeks, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, right. That's, we'll wait for the legal briefs on tape to come out for you.
Yeah, yeah.
but it's true, and it's a great kind of primer on First Amendment law. And
ACLU has some experience with that. They're a good source on this, I think.
And it contains great bits like Bob Murray thinks John Oliver was mean to him and doesn't want him to be mean again. While that is sad for Bob Murray, it is unconstitutional for a court to order such relief. It's a really, really good illustration of how to write sarcasm in the law. But again, you know, I know we've got law students and lawyers who listen to the show. I want to urge a tiny bit of caution here. This is a strong play, and you have to know you have a strong hand before you write a brief like this. And again, you know, I have written some sarcastic briefs in my day, and of
you ever
them,
been burned? Ever been wrong?
I wouldn't say wrong, but I would say there are certainly briefs that I wrote in my 20s mocking the other side that I think in retrospect that language was not helpful. Mm. The only one that I would stand by that was kind of like this was I have talked before about the most meritless lawsuit I was involved in where the guy did a global search and replace for, you know, tobacco with alcohol and sought $1 million, quote, you know, $1 billion in damages. And I wrote that, you know, a million billion is a quadrillion dollars, which exceeds the net value of the entirety of the assets of the Western Hemisphere. and I stand by that bit of sarcasm, right?
That's descriptive. That's just a fact claim.
Right, right. Well, and there was more, I mean, it was not as well written as the ACLU brief, but that, you know, if you're going to make a strong play like this, you've got to be awfully confident. Yeah. And I would encourage, remember when you're a lawyer, gosh, I hate to be like the lawyer, the lawyer podcast guy who's occasionally funny coming out against sarcasm and humor, but like, remember when you're a lawyer that like the goal of your writing a brief is to get the right outcome for your client and ask yourself, you know, is this kind of language more or less likely to get the outcome that I want for my client? Or am I placing, you know, my desire to write something that I'm proud of over that sort of outcome? And the more, you know, as I got more experienced as a lawyer, that became more of kind of a,
but when you do a legal entertainment show like we do, maybe, you know,
right,
insert
yeah,
some exactly. snark, you know, we're not,
we don't need any more legal entertainment shows though. This is more than enough. We have occupied the landscape.
Yeah. We're good. All right. Well, that's awesome. I do encourage everybody read that, the ACLU amicus brief. That's good stuff. And now it is my favorite time of the week. My co-favorite time. It is New Patron Tuesday.
And now that it's Tuesday, I have to say, I like New Patron Tuesday the best.
Yeah, you know, it's so weird. I was thinking last week, like, oh, maybe I like Top Patron Friday better. But it really, now I feel kind of the opposite. It's just so fickle. So fickle.
I agree. and we have a lot of new patrons to thank.
Oh, wow.
And,
yeah, we do.
And I want to reemphasize, we did just drop out an awful lot of great new stuff.
Yep.
We've got the live Q&A. We're going to do that every month. I think we had a terrific time. We had about 100 people on short notice. We're going to give you more notice next time. There was great interaction among the OA fans, not just between, you know, you guys and us, but among each other. And we went for, gosh, almost 2 hours. And we went a long time because it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really was.
And obviously, Lawed Awful Movies.
Of course. it was really fun. But we got to thank our new patrons, Heather G. Peters, Faye Matthews, Soul, Andrew, Beth Swope. Pepsi is the way, the truth, and the life. Awesome. Yaga, co-host of the Shifty Bastards Transformation Podcast, with a pledge edit. Thank you, Yaga. Jay Meissen, Daniel Van Heel, Adam Ferrucci, Lord Chad, fourth Earl of Catsuit, Robin, Antonin Scalia. Oh, good. Well, wow. That's, you know, we talk a lot of trash on Antonin Scalia, but the fact that he could still pledge the show and, you know, being dead and all that, I got to say, hats off to Antonin Scalia. Tom Giorgio, Jonathan Groper, Stephen Eagles, Chuck Duckhoff of the Staggerly Archives, and Grand Duke Nile, the Lagormophile, or you say it's Lagomorphile, I don't know. One or the other. Sarah McGuire and Ryan Flowers. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, and thank you to Shane Phillips, to Crystal, to Jared Kester, Stephen Cranford, Trevoricus, some sort of dinosaur, I assume. Thank you to Dante 225, to Rebecca Smelzer, Richard Grant, Christopher Peterson, Raymond Michael Purdy. Thank you to Peter in Korea. Wow, I love when we get international listeners. Thank you to Ed Orth. Thank you to Fee Fi Forfana. So we are not playing the name game on this, but thank you, Fee Fi Forfana, for the pledge edit. Cameron Young, Tamara Hausch, Michael C. Sampson, and April Poff. Thank you all so much for pledging. We literally could not do the show in the way in which we do the show to you without your support. So I hope that this always comes across as sincerely as we mean it, which is, you know, you make the show possible.
No socialist.
Thank you very, very much.
Absolutely.
Ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right, Andrew, time for my, I would say for another 5 minutes here, still one of my favorite parts of the show while I'm still at 50%. Hold on, let me just enjoy being at 50% for just another few seconds here, because this last bar question was really difficult, but let me just breathe it in. I just want to enjoy the feeling of I'm at 50%. All right, time to give me the answer. What's going on here?
Okay. Yeah. Thomas, this was a difficult question because of the tremendous amount of information, almost all of it distracting, that was in the question. Right. And so we had a man who voluntarily checked himself into a mental health facility. There was a totally irrelevant bit about checking himself out, but the key facts were he told the facility he was angry at his wife and he wanted to hurt her. Despite that, the hospital released him for the weekend anyway, and he went out and shot his wife. And then the man's children sued the hospital for negligence. So the question is, the hospital files a motion to dismiss, arguing that there is no privity between the decedent and no duty owed to her. Okay. So will the court grant the motion to dismiss? This requires you to know what's privity, and is there a duty owed between the hospital and somebody that the hospital had no connection with, right?
Yeah.
So first, what's privity? Privity is any relationship between the parties that is recognized by law. Okay. So now, what is the idea of no duty? When you file a negligence claim, you are saying that somebody failed to exercise the relevant duty of care to you as the plaintiff. And one of the most common things that you learn your first year of law school is there's no such thing as negligence in the air. Oh. All of our law student listeners and all of our lawyers listeners can say that. So there has to be some connection. Why does the hospital – so the threshold question is, does the hospital have a duty to the wife and her kids even though, right, that there's no obvious connection? So – the answers were two no answers. That is to say, the court would not grant the motion to dismiss.
I just want to point out that as of right now, I'm at 50% for the
correct.
Just as of this moment now. Okay.
You eliminated the two yes answers. You said that the court is not likely to grant the motion to dismiss. You eliminated C. Yes, because there is no duty to control the conduct of another person to prevent that person from harming others. That's a good elimination. we often have in the law, when you know that a third party is about to do something, you have a duty in some way to exercise some care about that person.
I did one thing right. Okay, one thing right.
And you eliminated D. Yes, because the intervening acts of third parties are unforeseeable and cannot give rise to liability. Intervening acts by a third party may be unforeseeable, but they may be foreseeable.
Yeah, yeah.
So good elimination. Woo! D is also
second
an incorrect
chance,
answer.
Bar exam, so, law firm alive still. Okay, well, that's good.
Thomas's second chance law firm is alive and kicking. So now we have to choose which no answer is correct. You eliminated A, no, because the hospital is strictly liable for releasing patients who it knows or should know represent an unreasonable danger to third persons.
Could have been right. That's
a really, really attractive answer, but I have to tell you, it's a good elimination.
No way!
There is no...
Wow.
There is no strict liability for the hospital for releasing patients who it knows or should know represent unreasonable danger to third persons. It is in fact that the special relationship and control between the doctor and an inpatient mandates due care by the doctor to prevent a foreseeable danger to others. So how is that privity relationship established? Because the doctor has a relationship with the patient, and then under the restatement of torts, section 319,
which we all know,
duty of those in charge of person having dangerous propensities, one who takes charge of a third person whom he knows or should know to be likely to cause bodily harm to others if not controlled, is under a duty to exercise reasonable care to control the third person to prevent him from doing such harm. So that's the distinction. Strict liability is
you put
that person in restraints, right? You know, it's like Terminator 2, right? They're locked up in the, you know, Linda Hamilton is locked up in the maximum security ward and strapped down to the bed and manacles. And she's, because, you know, she's turned into this unstoppable would-be revolutionary. She manages through, you know, elaborate contrivance to get out from her restraint. And then, yeah, that would be, if you were strictly liable, it doesn't matter, right? Everything she does is the fault of the hospital.
Yeah, I just thought that language was a little too strong. I think that's why I went away from it. Boy, whew.
That's what strict liability means. It means you are strictly liable regardless of the steps you've taken to prevent harm. You're not, but you do have a duty to exercise reasonable care, and that's what you picked. I think you did a fantastic job. Obviously, there's a little bit of good luck, but there's a little bit of bad luck on some of the previous questions.
True.
You did a great job on the issue spotting. And
boy, that was a tough
one. And
you
are now 18 for 35.
I think I'm ready to practice law.
Over 50%.
I think I'm ready to practice law at this point. I'm going to start looking for offices. I'm going to start. I think I can take the first steps because that was... Wow. I had no confidence in getting that right. But, you know, then again, I suppose there's probably not much of a market for a lawyer that's like, well, I'll probably guess this right, but I don't know. Yeah.
I'm picturing now, and any of our listeners who are really skilled with Photoshop, I am picturing Thomas's face on the back of a bus with, you know, Thomas Smith Esquire, quote, yeah, we'll probably
chances
guess the right
are,
answer
I
eventually.
Will be right about your legal question. Like, chances are, that's just 50 plus a little bit percent.
It's more,
yeah.
It's a valid claim. You could say it's more likely than not that he'll guess the right answer.
Oh,
outstanding.
Man.
No, I'm very proud, very happy. When you went with B, it was all I could do not to just giggle with joy last week. So
you got a good poker face. I had no idea. I thought your poker voice. I don't know. I was worried that I blew it. Man, that's awesome. I've got a tiny bit of a cushion before I'm below 50% again. You know what that means, listeners? That means I'm going to be positive about this segment for at least another like week and a half. So there you go. All right, Andrew, who was our future Andrew? Who was our lucky winner this week? Besides me, because I think I was, but who got second place?
Thomas, this week's winner is Sam Ducharme. That is at Dork Elite on Twitter. And he gave the absolute best answer this week. Sam's answer was concise. It was B, Tarasoff. And Tarasoff is a reference to a case that I learned in law school. I think almost everybody learns about it in law school. It is Tarasoff versus Regents of the University of California. It's a California Supreme Court case that very closely tracks the facts of this hypothetical in this bar question and established that hospitals and other medical professionals have a duty to protect third parties from injury from their patients that is reasonably expected. And so that case really clearly establishes that there is some duty, but that duty is obviously not a strict liability duty. So good job citing to Tarasoff, way to engage the Wayback Machine and remind me of my law school years. And it was the best answer. It was super concise. Everyone should give at Dork Elite, DorkElite. Thanks, Sam. Congratulations on winning this week.
And that's it for today's show. I'm just riding the high of being greater than 50% on something, which, as you know, I gotta say, back when in my school days, that wouldn't have been, that's a pretty low bar. But because this is a very difficult bar exam, to make a stupid pun, I'm clearing that low bar and I'm very happy. So thanks for listening. Thanks for participating, everybody. And thanks most of all to our patrons who are enjoying the bonus content. We will see you for another newsworthy Friday episode.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.